Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist podcast at the Americatzentrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. It's election season in the United States, so you can expect a number of podcast episodes and live events about the elections from the Americatzentrum and our partners. Today's podcast episode is generously co-sponsored by the Association of German-American Centers, the Aspen Institute, and the U.S. Embassy in Berlin. A big thank you to all of our partners from the Americatzentrum team. Today we'll be discussing Republican and Democratic campaign strategies, as well as some issues that affect the large and influential Hispanic or Latino or Latinx population in the U.S. In fact, this could be the first presidential election that is decided by Hispanic voters in a few battleground states. It's also important to mention that the United States is currently celebrating Hispanic American Heritage Month, so it is fortunate that we have with us today a fantastic journalist from the New York Times who specializes in Latino politics, Jasmine Ulloa. So Jasmine, herzlich willkommen. Welcome to Germany and welcome to Hamburg. The German government just announced stricter border controls last week. So how was your experience crossing the German border?
Oh, it was great. I'm really happy to be here. I had no issues except for my luggage getting lost.
So. I'm sorry to hear that. It wasn't a German airline. It was SAS. So we'll blame the Scandinavians, which we're always happy to do. Okay, so you have already heard me use different words to describe the Latino community in the United States. So we can use Hispanic, Latino, Latinx. I've also now been using Latine with an E at the end. And there is some conflict about which terms are appropriate. So maybe we can start our conversation by using this confusion about language as a way to discuss the enormous diversity of the Latino community in the USA. The Latino community has regional differences, political differences, historical differences, when did they arrive, linguistic differences, class differences, and of course, differences in national origin. So is a Cuban-American voter in Florida similar in any way to a Mexican-American voter in California or a Puerto Rican voter in New York? Does it make sense anymore to talk about the Hispanic vote or the Latino vote? Jasmine.
Yeah, so let me first start off by saying that we don't even agree on the term. And it's been a big debate in the states, especially in the recent elections, as there's been debate about which direction voters are going, right? There's a lot of debate about Democrats, Republicans, you know, are Latino voters inherently Republican because of these conservative familial values that we grew up with, that our culture, you know, imbues in us. So there's Hispanic that was, you know, created by the government as Hispanic Americans were being counted in the census. There's Latino, which refers to anybody who traces their origins to Latin America, but not doesn't necessarily include Spanish ancestry as Hispanic does. And then there's, you know, more recent terms like Chicano or Chicana, which was used mainly by Mexican Americans in the Southwest that were trying to assert their civil rights in the United States and more visibility in the United States. And then more recent terms like Latinx, which is used by a younger generation trying to make the language more inclusive. And then, of course, there's a lot of debate about whether this is just coming from academia or intellectuals and being imposed on the community. There was actually a Pew Research Center study that came out this week that found that more Latinos now know about the term Latinx, but it's still only 4% actually use it. So...
So for the purposes of your day-to-day life or in your professional life, do you just now prefer Latino?
Yeah, we usually we go by Hispanic or Latino. We kind of use those terms interchangeably in our reporting just
to make life easier. But we could also talk about the various differences in this community. So I mentioned three examples: Mexican-American voter in California, Puerto Rican voter in New York, and Cuban American in Florida. Would you say it's better to describe those voters in that way, or should we just lump them all together as Latino voters?
When I'm speaking to voters in the day-to-day, I think people prefer to be identified by their nation of origin. So Mexican-American, Puerto Rican, it just says a lot more about the person. But I think there's still some usefulness in that Latino label, because there is that cultural affinity that we have and the experience. I mean, this is at the crux of the debate. There's some people that feel like, you know, more Latinos are being born in the United States. You know, we're 3, 4, 5 generations in now. They're voting more in line with every other American voter out there. But at the same time, we still face discrimination in a lot of areas. There was a mass shooting that targeted Mexican Americans. The shooter, who identified himself as a white supremacist, was going to shoot Hispanic Americans. He was targeting all Hispanic Americans. So
this was the one in Texas, yeah?
Yes, in Texas, in August 2019. Latino leaders, Latino political organizers find a lot of power in solidarity in identifying as Latino voters.
Great. And you mentioned the Pew Center and the census already, and I have some stats for us prepared. So according to the census, and it was the government who started identifying people as such, as Hispanic, I think was that the first term the census used. And for many different immigrant groups throughout the United States.
For a short time, there was actually like Mexican for a really, really short time in, I believe, in the 30s. So they've tried to account for the group in various ways.
Right. And often with many groups, it is the government who just chooses to identify a certain way, like many Native American tribes. And now I'm going way back in history.
Yes.
Didn't identify themselves by the tribal names that the government gave them. But since the government needed to identify these people as something in their treaty negotiations, they just called them whatever they wanted to, and then they became what they are. So this follows many groups. But according to the census, there are 65 million Hispanics in the U.S., and that's 19.5% of the population. And this is growing to such an extent, the Hispanic population, that we do expect to see. Is it the Hispanic minority becoming a majority by 2050, or is it just that non-Hispanic whites will be a minority?
I believe it's the latter. I believe it's the latter.
Why is it that his Hispanic population is going to become the biggest one? Is it just immigration, or are we talking immigration plus having babies?
No. I think it's the latter. But I actually also brought stats. And it's such a huge population, but I think it speaks to how marginalized the demographic has been in the United States. The number of eligible voters in the United States is 36.2 million Latino voters, and that's up from 32.3 million in 2020, and these are Pew numbers. That's up from 2020, when they became the largest voters of color, or the largest minority voters in the United States. So that would be about, you know, 15% of the American electorate, but actually they only made up 10% of voters in 2020. And Pew actually found that campaigns reach out to Latino voters less than they do Black or white voters in the United States. And so I think that just speaks a lot to the story of this population in the United States, just how neglected it's been in American politics, and why there's been these movements throughout time to participate, to increase political power, to identify as Latino voters in the United States.
And I want to focus on this a little bit more, the fact that it's about 15% of eligible voters. But so you would think, okay, this is a voting bloc that we should really cater to. But according to the University of Florida Election Laboratory, Hispanic voters only turn out at 52.5%. And this was in 2020, as opposed to non-Hispanic Black voters. So Black voters at 65%, and then white voters at 72%. So I think there are two sides to this equation. One is political campaigns neglect the Latino vote. But the other side is maybe Latino voters don't themselves go out and vote too. So right. When you're looking at both sides of this equation, how do you analyze it?
Yeah, I mean, and some of it is immigration. You know, it can be a transient population in some ways, but also, you know, as people arrive and establish roots, it takes a while to trust the political system, depending on what, you know, history from what country they come from. You know, not all Latinos trust the government or trust that both parties can deliver. I hear that a lot in the interviews. It's just like, why? They're all the same. You know, politicians are all the same. That's been a big challenge, a big hurdle for Latino organizers and political activists trying to increase those numbers. There's a wide number of reasons of why this is. This is why it's such a critical group in this election. This is why Latinos are such a pure swing group, is because they don't really have a strong affinity to any party right now. For a long time, they've voted Democrat, and overall, they still, most Latinos lean Democrat, and that's been the case. There's always been about a third since the 90s. There's always been about a third that have voted Republican, but this year you're really seeing both parties reach out to the demographics in ways they haven't before, and you're seeing a sophistication in the way that they are reaching out to the demographic in ways that we haven't seen in past elections.
Can you describe some of those ways that you've noticed in your experience?
Yes, for a long time, when Latinos were reached out to, there was a lot of pandering, a lot of, you know, throwing in Spanish phrases, even if they didn't always make sense, talking about food, always talking about immigration.
And thinking of the horrible Donald Trump taco salad image. But yes, yeah. That is pandering at its finest.
Yes. So for a long time, we've seen that. And also talking about immigration, even though poll after poll for years has shown that the top issue for Latino voters is the economy and this idea of coming to the United States to achieve the American dream and that upward mobility. And this year, we're really seeing less of that. We're seeing more appeals from, you know, younger members of Congress, like Maxwell Frost in Florida, Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez in New York, who's Puerto Rican. They're really focused on a class message, on a message about, you know, helping the middle class. The Democrats are here to protect and help the middle class, really focused on those economic issues. You have, for example, Ruben Gallego, who is of Mexican and Colombian descent in Arizona, running in a very, very tight race in Arizona. He had a prime speaking spot at the DNC, at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And he focused on his military background, on his veteran experience. And many of them didn't even speak Spanish, didn't even speak a word of Spanish throughout, because they felt like it was too pandering. They didn't need to. Their name, their identity spoke for itself. And that's very, very different. On the other side, we're also seeing new ways of reaching out to Latino voters. The Trump campaign has rebranded itself as Latino Americans for Trump. He also he speaks a lot about the economy and what his administration did to help small businesses and Latino unemployment. And then there's also this, you know, this, of course, this more insidious side to the campaign, which is stirring divisions between documented and undocumented Latino voters, immigrants, and Black voters. So really, really, really trying to stir divisions in a very diverse electorate that is also itself in the midst of demographic change, as the United States is in the midst of demographic change.
Right. We're going to drill down into immigration and border issues just in a bit, but I just want to stay here on the point you made about not speaking Spanish at the DNC. And I didn't listen to every speech, but I listened to most of them. And indeed, I don't think I heard a single word of Spanish at all. But it was funny, I was talking to some other American friends of mine who lived here in Germany. And we said, we would also feel pandered to if a political party here found out somehow that we were Americans now residing in Germany. And they said, oh, well, just let's assume that they don't understand what's going on. So let's send them voting information and political information in English. We'd just be like, okay, thanks. But it would just be a little turnoff. So we were kind of happy to see that, you know, I kind of understand, being an immigrant myself, that I wouldn't want to be pandered to like that. So I thought that was just a little point. You mentioned swing states, though. And I do have just a couple of stats here about two major swing states, Nevada and Arizona, both southwestern states. Arizona has 25% of its population is Latin American voters, and Nevada is 22. So I think you've done a lot of traveling around the border. Maybe we can just start with Arizona. What's Arizona like, and how does the Hispanic population feel there about what's going on in the election, maybe both last one and this one coming up?
Yeah, so Arizona, intense state right now. It's So Arizona is a state where Latinos have been trying to build political power for years now, and where they've felt targeted by state laws trying to crack down on immigration. There was one sheriff in particular, Joe Arpaio, who was jailing undocumented immigrants, forcing them to wear pink underwear, using pink handcuffs, really degrading, using some really degrading tactics that Latino groups saw as really dehumanizing language toward undocumented immigrants, and these state laws that required people to carry around documentation of their citizenship. They were called show me your papers laws. So Arizona is a very red leaning state. It has been a very conservative state for years. But since 2011, we've seen Latinos really build their political power in response to these really draconian, hardline immigration measures that many Latinos felt were targeting their families. Since then, you've seen the parties kind of move further to the right and further to the left. The candidates who are running in the state at the highest levels, we were seeing this increasing divide between the parties. During the 2022 midterm, we had a slate of candidates that was probably the peak of the division, because we had a slate of candidates that were running in the mold of Donald Trump. And so they were returning to a lot of that intense rhetoric that many felt had been fought and pushed back in the last 20 years. And we were seeing this rise in election denialism. The prime example of like where Arizona is at is that Senate race now, which is between Carrie Lake, who lost in 2022 and is a Trump protege, or has considered herself a Trump protege. And she's a former TV anchor with no political experience, first time candidate. And she's up against this congressman who has himself a very liberal background, rose because of these movements, these progressive movements in the state that helped counter a lot of that extremism. And so I think that is going to be a really interesting race that dictates the direction of that state, where that state is headed. And the top issues there are the border, of course. Carrie Lake and Republicans see the border and painting the Democrats as promoting open borders and chaos as a winning strategy. Like I said, Gallego spoke at the DNC. He's really focused on keeping the conversation on the economy and on the middle class and on protecting the middle class, and trying to tamper down his more liberal record, or getting painted as too left on a lot of these issues.
In general, the Democrats are trying to run more towards the center, and the Republicans in this cycle are trying to run more farther to the right. Is that your overall assessment, or is that too much of a generalization?
It's right in some aspects, but for example, Carrie Lake ran so far to the right in 2022 and she lost. And so what we're seeing her is actually coming back a little bit more to the center right, or at least casting herself as now this Republican who is welcoming to all kinds of Democrats and all Republicans. So in 2022, we saw a lot of this debate about rhinos, right? Which kind of became a slur in the Republican Party, right? Republican in name only, or not Republican enough, this ideological purity. And when she ran in 2022, she castigated a lot of her fellow Republicans for not supporting, saying she didn't need the support of Trump skeptical Republicans. And we're not hearing that same message this time around.
So there is a little bit of softening, too. There's a little bit of moving to the center for the most extreme MAGA Republicans.
Center right.
Center right. Okay. let's focus in more now on immigration issues in the border. And just for our German audience, I think it's important physically to understand what we're talking about, the border. The U.S. border with Mexico is 3,100 kilometers long, so that's roughly 2,000 miles. So just to give you a sense of how long that is, Germany has a border with 9 countries, and that is 3,800 kilometers long, or 2,340 miles. So the German border all around Germany is obviously surrounded by other countries, and it's huge. The U.S. border with Mexico is huge, too. And as I was saying at the start today, half in jest, the current German government wants to now reinstitute border checks at all of these border crossings that, you know, since Schengen was passed, have been mostly taken down. So the U.S. has an enormously long, and I would argue, unpoliceable border with Mexico, just like Germany can't police every all of those 3,000 kilometers of its own border. And we were talking about Arizona. So Arizona is a border state. As I said, 25% of the voters there are of Latino or Hispanic origin. It's hard for me to understand from here that when a Kerry Lake type or a Trump type says, we want to do mass deportation, or we want to build this wall, or now talking about the Haitian immigrants, immigrants are eating your pets, your dogs and cats. I mean, just kind of from an emotional level, I don't understand, if I were a Latino immigrant or of Latino heritage, how I could possibly be one of these Hispanic voters who would support what is very, as you said, dehumanizing language. I can understand why a Hispanic would vote Democrat, but not quite Republican. But this is my view from far away. So since there are a third of voters who support the Republican Party and Trump, how are they explaining their support for Trump as Latino Americans, given all of this other stuff?
Yeah, so for a really long time, the Republican Party talked about legal and illegal immigration and really made that distinction between there's a right way and there's a wrong way of doing it. And so I think that was the appeal for a lot of Republicans, that historic third of Latinos who have been Republicans. It wasn't necessarily that they're against immigration. They just wanted legal immigration, a proper and fair process. And I think that that's the message that I still hear from a lot of Latino Republicans today, is that that's what they want. They want, you know, and there's this whole conception, we can talk about whether it's accurate or not, but there's this whole conception that, well, my family did it the right way. We waited, we applied, it took us years, but we did it, and we did it the right way. And of course, the U.S. system, both parties, you know, members of both parties agree, is broken. It's overcrowded, it's underfunded. Sometimes it takes a lifetime now, the way the system is now, how broken it is, it could take a lifetime to do it the right way. And there are a lot of people in very desperate situations that are having to flee and apply for asylum at the border, which is a legal U.S. right. But I think people are getting these images on Fox News or right-wing media where you just see these masses of people at the border and, you know, the massless, faceless, it just becomes this mass. It fuels these feelings of like, oh, there's just chaos. And that's what I hear from Latino voters. And then the other thing about this election is that it's really a vibes election. It's a feelings election. People are not really familiar with the policies of either candidate. So what I'm hearing more from voters is, well, I trust Trump more on the border. He's strong. You know, he's a family man. He's a businessman. All these things that we were hearing in 2016, I'm still hearing them today from Latino voters. But then once I actually start to explain, well, he's made these promises that he's pledging to enact the largest mass deportation project in the history of the United States. Do you remember Operation, and I won't use the slur, but there's an operation in the 1950s under Eisenhower,
Operation WB, yeah.
which was named after a slur for Latinos. And it targeted a lot of Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, people who were born in the United States. I think it expelled more than a million people. So once I explain that history, many haven't heard of that history, haven't heard of that operation. When I say no, Trump, when we've asked the former president how he plans to enact this mass deportation, he's pointed to that specific operation as a model that many are not aware of that. And they're horrified, I should say. They respond either with actually laughter, like, no way, that couldn't have happened here. And like, no, this actually did happen. This is how this candidate is saying he's going to undertake this promise. Then I get the stunned looks. But again, it's such a hard decision for each voter. These are the common responses I get. It's either they're not familiar with the policies, they're not familiar with how former President Trump plans to undertake these promises, or they do know and they don't believe that he can do it because he pledged a bunch of these policies and he made a bunch of these promises in 2016. And they're like, well, where's the wall he said he was going to build? He didn't build the wall. And oh, remember, Democrats went wild last time suggesting that we were all going to be deported and put in camps, and we're not in camps. So there's a disbelief that he can actually carry out these policies, that there are checks and balances still in the United States.
Just to break in here, so if they're giving you those three explanations, so then they're saying, but we're going to vote for Trump and the Republican Party based on then economic and
exactly. That's where I was getting.
Issues.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and then that's where I was that's exactly where I was going with that. The third thing I hear is, well, the economy is the most important thing to me. And he, you know, yes, he says things that are off the cuff or not, you know, I don't agree with. And yes, it disgusts me, but I felt, again, feelings, I felt that my life was better under Trump economically.
That's really interesting. One point of clarification just for a European audience. So obviously in Germany, here where we're recording, any policeman at any time can ask you for your identity papers for no reason. This is not something that you can do in the United States. So when we're talking about like the mass deportation stuff or this stop and show me your papers law, it really, I think for Americans, touches on our sense that the government and the police shouldn't be able to stop us at any time and say, where are your identity papers? So just culturally, Germans and the French, who also have such a requirement, we're very far away from Americans when it comes to having to prove your legal status in a country whenever any police officer asks you. So that's that.
Well, and there's a history. There's the history. There's an ugly history to that in the United States about who gets asked more frequently for that type of information, and that it's often based on ethnic profiling. That was the main concern in Arizona and has been the concern in states like Texas that are now considering similar laws.
Great. So as we turn now maybe to a final point, I just want to discuss the swing states where Hispanics have a small percentage of the vote, but still could be key. And here now I'm looking at Michigan, which has a 4% Hispanic population, Wisconsin at 5%, and Pennsylvania at 6%. So small compared to Arizona's 25%, but still when we're talking about maybe 20 or 30,000 votes deciding an election, 5% of the electorate is huge. So have you noticed anything special going on with the very small minority of Hispanic voters in those three swing states in the North?
Oh, yeah. No, I see both campaigns are going hard after those voters. And I'd add Georgia and North Carolina to that list, even though the numbers are smaller there as well. But especially in Pennsylvania, I think the battle is really on for Latino voters in Pennsylvania. You know, you have a lot of Puerto Ricans who have moved out of New York to pursue these factory jobs in Pennsylvania. And, you know, just this week you had the Harris campaign launch a big radio and TV buy with a very popular Puerto Rican, a radio personality there. And you're seeing both campaigns really, really crisscross that state.
Yeah, and do you think, are they focusing on the same issues they're focusing on in border states in the South? So the Democrats, on the one hand, are focusing on economic issues and maybe some social justice issues, and the Republicans are focusing also on the economy, but also the border. Strict border stuff.
Yeah, you're seeing, I think that those are going to be the issues that decide the election. I mean, for Democrats, it's really this message about the middle class, freedom, protecting the freedom to make your personal choices because of abortion restrictions. So for Democrats, the issue of abortion is really big, and especially among Latinas, that was such a big driver in the 2022 elections. You had so many Latinas who cited abortion restrictions and the loss of Roe as the reason that they were voting, and many times for the first time in an election. And then for Republicans is again promoting that the fears about immigration and crime, and well, look at these newer immigrants that are coming in. They're not like you, Latino voters, who have been here for a long time now and are following the laws, really spreading that message. And of course, the economy. I was better on the economy and will be better on the economy again. That's what we hear a lot from the campaign.
Okay, so it's going to be an exciting couple of months before we get to Election Day. Are you going to be crisscrossing, after you're done crisscrossing Germany, are you going to be back to crisscrossing the United States?
Oh, yes. Yes, I don't think I'm going to be home for a while.
All right. Jasmine Ulloa, New York Times reporter, politics reporter, thank you so much for joining me today. You know, I usually ask all my guests to give an election prediction. Do you want to give an election prediction, or shall we just end it here?
No, thank you. No, thank
you. Smart. I think we've all been burned before by having to make predictions on tape. Jasmine, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.